This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, joining you this August 31st, 2014. I thank you so much for joining me here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. As always, please check out all the other great hosts on this network. There is sure a lot of content to go through, so please stop by the site and leave some comments. Also, I would like to encourage you to check out all of the different websites that are affiliated with this network, such as Alternative Social, Renegade Tribune, Aryan Women. We've got now White Artwork at whiteartwork.com in its infancy. Also recently brought to life is prowhitemarket.com. Please stop by there, see what it's all about. And if you are interested in buying or selling over there, just get in contact. It's very easy. Tonight, folks, I have a guest with me who was on the Oracle Broadcasting Network with me years ago, Jason Erb from Exposing Faux Capitalism. Actually, Jason is one of the only people who really stood up for me after I was given the boot, and he wrote about it on his blog, which is fauxcapitalist.com. So please go and check that out. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kyle. It's great to be on your show tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Let's start from the beginning here by talking about your background and what got you into this area of research, area of thought. And then what we'll do is in the first hour go through a number of different talking points concerning this topic of money, of how it's used, its history, in particular its history in the United States, why it is important. And then what we're going to do is we're going to transition and talk about the larger spectrum of the alternative media, the conspiracy crowd, if you will. And we'll get your opinion on that. We'll talk about Jewish power and control. We'll talk about white genocide. We'll talk about whoever and whatever you'd like, Jason. But to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in capitalism?
So I grew up in Canada, and around 2006, that's when I woke up to an alternative perspective of looking at all different kinds of world events, politics, economics especially, and then also some of the conspiracy facts that I hadn't been aware of at the time. And it was through Alex Jones, but then over the course of 6 years, actually, by 2012, then I realized exactly what he was all about. That's how long it took. And then I had been a regular listener to him for about a year and a half, starting in 2006. And I got him to uncover the AIDS scam and then did some radio with the producer of the documentary. One of the best documentaries came out in the mid-90s, Exposing That Scam.
And what's the name of that one? I know about House of Numbers.
Yeah, that's the second biggest one there. Okay. The first one was HIV equals AIDS factor fraud.
Okay, I'll have to check.
Was released in 1996. Yeah, yeah, it's actually good because it captures a lot of the feelings of the early AIDS epidemic, which is like key to understanding how they were able to pull off the scam. People's emotions is one big thing, and of course the very powerful fast-track gay lobby that existed in there. And, of course, they were enabled by certain power, which we'll later on in the show.
Yeah, it's interesting, an interesting topic for sure, especially because it was gays and minorities, basically inner-city blacks, who were mainly affected by this. And many of them became conspiratorial because they thought it was some kind of plan to get rid of them. But it turns out that it could have been a far bigger and more complex plan that most people weren't even considering, that the disease might not really be what you think it is. But maybe we could get into that later. What got you into the topic of the monetary system? Why did you feel like this was such an important component to focus on?
I had always been really interested in economics and finance since the early 1990s, and I was following a lot of the mainstream discussion about it during that time, following all the time near the end of the Reagan era. You had the Bush, and then, of course, in 2001 and that. And so what actually happened around 2007, just before the official collapse in September of 2008 when Lehman Brothers went down. So a year before that, actually, when the subprime thing had started in 2007, I had already been, like, talking a lot about it, researching things, and had, like, a lot of things that were on my mind of things to discuss that just wasn't being discussed in the mass media. And so by the time that whole thing happened in September, and then by January of the following year, that's when I started up my blog, faux-capitalist.com. And now there's about nearly 1,000 articles on there. Originally, it did start out pretty much with a 100% focus on economics and things related to political aspects of that. But then it started branching out more into all different other kinds of areas, which has kind of been one of the real fun aspects of it, as it were, of like branching out based upon like an organic research activity. This is one of the problems that I noticed with some of the prominent people that are put out there in the so-called alternative media, like Alex Jones being one, is that trying to think of a way that he's actually changed his views on certain things. Like, you can listen. This is what Lee Rogers had said when I listened to him, about how you can go back to Alex Jones from 10 years ago and he's saying pretty much exactly the same sort of thing as he would say now. And that's one thing that really irked me. So it's just been like a really big learning experience. And I take the blog and all my efforts with the radio show exactly to what I think are the biggest issues as they unfold. So at the time it was this whole financial thing. And the big thing was just, even before the thing happened, like, I didn't know about these credit default swaps. But when I heard about them, it was like obvious that there was going to be a problem to have unregulated insurance policies on whatever assets that they were trading around. And so that just seemed that it would eventually go and blow up. And then, of course, I started to find out what that was really all about, that they had to go and pump up after there was the whole problem there with the thing in the 80s is when it had to be pumped up there under Alan Greenspan.
Well, let's actually get to that in a little bit. First, can you define what faux capitalism is? And you spell it F-A-U-X. I guess it could also be appropriately called faux capitalism, spelled F-O-E. But what do you mean by fake capitalism here? And could you please also describe what you consider real capitalism to be?
So originally, when I came up with that name, that I was describing faux capitalism to be what I had seen with Wall Street, with these credit default swaps, with the fact that, as it turned out, that these mortgages had actually not been exchanged in the proper way, that according to the common law, that you had to have it be traced in, well, at the time it was like bookkeeping records, but then a database now. Everything had to be cleared that way, but they were actually going and breaking it up into pieces, these different mortgages, and trading it on their own system. So it was this whole corruption that was going on that you could easily point to. And also the fact, like, the U.S. government was in bed with going and backing up and actually encouraging the semi-governmental agencies of Fannie Mae to go and give out these loans to people who had no business having them. Like, it was laughable here up in Canada because of the regulations are pretty tight here, that, like, we would just laugh hearing about that people could actually go and get mortgages without a credit check. That would never happen here in Canada. So originally it was, that's what I saw as faux capitalism, but then actually I realized that actually capitalism itself is faux capitalism, because I found out that what really built the United States into the economic powerhouse it was actually free enterprise. And over the years, I've heard some people seemingly independently recognize this. I just heard this from others, like, early on. But there are some people who seem to independently recognize this, is that really the really good system, in my view, is free enterprise, with the distinction being that capitalism is where you have large amounts of capital and few people going and controlling the levers of the whole economic system through the court system and through these special arrangements they have with the central banks and that. Mm-hmm. So free enterprise takes that all away. And I think there is a role for government involved with the monetary system, but I think specifically for issuing the money supply to pay for the actual legitimate functions of government, which certainly in the case of the federal government, I would define as the defense of the nation, and specifically being the actual defense, like actually having the militia. There is no militia in the United States right now. constitutionally defined. And so they should actually have a militia down at the border going enforcing the immigration laws, for instance. So that would be a proper use, I'd say, where the government could issue money for that, but not a proper use then to go and redistribute wealth to people. But then it does get into a very important issue. This is another thing. Then some people will say, well, we don't want wealth redistribution. I agree. Of course, there is the provision for if there's theft of money, then the ownership does not transfer by the thief from whom they went and stole it from. So there is that issue. But I think overall that if you let the market run things with like reasonable regulations, such as the court system of enforcing contracts, I think that ideally is the best way to go, that these, even the thefts and that could be dealt with. But certainly the high crimes of theft of where there were these trillions of dollars, up to over 16 trillions of dollars that were just, it was a Main Street mugging. That's what someone used the term there. I think that should definitely be dealt with through government policy to go and take that money back.
Isn't it interesting that contracts themselves didn't even used to be so legal? Oftentimes they were done with just a handshake or just somebody's word. Because maybe people were just more honorable back then, or they were able to be held more accountable. But now it seems like we're just inherently distrustful of everyone and everything, because in many regards, there are a lot of things out there that are set up to screw us over. There are many different scams and traps and all sorts of things. And I'd say one of the biggest ones here is this United States federal government, where basically – we are required through the force of arms to pay a certain amount of our labor, a certain amount of our working hours directly to the federal government in the form of taxes. And this is, in fact, slavery. And it would be one thing if this federal government was actually looking out for our interests. But in fact, they are taking that money. They are redistributing it to illegal aliens, to oppressed minorities in the form of basically reparations, though they don't call them that, and they still demand more reparations. They are putting through this anti-white agenda with white taxpayer dollars. And so I think that this is one of the biggest frauds, the biggest crimes that there is. And I was originally attracted to this material because of Ron Paul and the libertarian movement. I don't know if I would consider myself a libertarian currently, but the way you were speaking before makes me think that you possibly have, or you possibly still do, consider yourself a libertarian. What's your stance on that?
If you define libertarianism to be that the government should exist to protect the natural rights of the people, then that's the definition that I would subscribe to. And I think there's some very important things that aren't apparent to people, because they have these people who have been around in the media, in the alternative media, like Lou Rockwell, for like over 20 years, who they're the poster boys then for what libertarianism is. And and it's almost as if that they get to decide that this is what libertarian is, such as that, oh, the government has no business whatsoever in being involved in issuing any money. Well, I take exception with that, because I can see how, just the same way that you have, unless you're an anarchist, that you have a government to protect the rights. Well, why should they have to borrow from a private entity? Like, and that's one case where the Bible is correct, of the borrower becomes the slave to the lender. And that's the whole issue, is that, but I'm one of the few then who does come from at least following a lot of the libertarian circles, who actually does have that exception then, that the government should be able to issue the money supply. But overall, most of them believe that either there shouldn't be a government, or that the government should borrow from private interests, and they'll actually justify it as good. Oh, that'll keep the governments in check. Well, I don't see that happening in the case of the United States, as an example, which is borrowing from the privately owned Federal Reserve. And even beyond that, that 95% of all the money supply is created by the private banks anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Lou Rockwell, and he's the head of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Is he taking most of his positions from Ludwig von Mises, or has he altered that somewhat? And what do you think about the Austrian school of economics in general?
Well, he's taking most of his things independently, but also, but it really came from Murray Rothbard, because he said this in an interview and in several interviews that Murray Rothbard is really his champion then. Because even though it's called the Mises Institute, he named it that after Ludwig von Mises, as opposed to F.I. Hayek, who was the guy who won the Nobel Prize, because he felt that Mises was more anti-state. But actually, Mises did believe in having a government, at least to, for criminal law, as I definitely do myself, that I'm not an anarchist, whereas Murray Rothbard is an anarchist, and so is Lou Rockwell. So that's where Lou Rockwell really gets his whole basis from. He actually said that it was Murray Rothbard then who convinced to hate the state. And as far as Austrian economics, that I wrote an article on my site over a year ago about the at least 10 things of where I don't agree with Austrian economics. And so this is the thing. It's often synonymous that, oh, if you're a libertarian, then you must support Austrian economics. And this is one of the myths that I want to dispel then, that is put out there. And it's put out there deliberately by some people like Lou Rockwell, especially Tom Woods as well, is another anarchist, is that some problems, I mentioned the biggest one there, but I don't see why the government has to go and borrow from private interests in order to fund its actual legitimate services, such as defense and the police for criminal law, sensible criminal law, like murder and theft, not the thing about arresting someone because they went and took too much cough medication within a certain amount of time. Is the case in one of those states? I'm sure that has to do with concerns about drug trafficking, but it's obviously ridiculous to most people who look at it.
Well, maybe you haven't seen what happens when some youths are sipping on the scissor. It can get quite out of hand. Anyway, it's a good point. Criminal justice, rather than justice for criminals, is an important function of the state. And what we see now is pretty much the complete opposite. They enforce laws when it suits them and will break incredible amount of laws when it benefits them. They are pick and choose, such as the laws concerning the border. They have actually gone after Arizona for trying to enforce what is actually federal law. And I'm talking about Eric Holder and Barack Obama and the travesty of justice that is taking place there. And they send out their social justice warriors to places like Ferguson to stir up trouble. And it's never about trying to actually figure out what crime that took place and who's responsible. There are many more agendas that are in place. And we'll get to that in the second hour, that's for sure. Let's talk about the beginning of America and actually go through a really abbreviated timeline of some of the important economic events that took place. But actually, before we do that, do you care to comment upon what set the stage for the American experiment and also for economics in general as we know it today?
So if you go back to the American Revolution then in 1775, and it was said that, I think it might have been Samuel Adams, but said that if it wasn't for Thomas Paine's common sense, then that Washington's sword would have been in vain. And so this is a real important point that some people think, oh, unless you're lying out there and leading a bunch of people, then you're not doing anything effective. And that's just not the case. But you have to wait for the right time, that Thomas Paine's common sense just came in the right time. Earlier than perhaps it would have gone over like so many different blog posts that a lot of us have made already to this point. But then in the right period of time, it can really have a big impact. And the thing was that you looked at the United States had a real agrarian society there. And I think it was, now I don't know if this is a real Thomas Jefferson quote, because that's another issue that I uncovered with the monetary quotes. A lot of them are misattributed or completely fabricated. But at least this is the one attributed. It brings up an important point, is that saying about how the independent livelihoods then that the Americans had, this is a key thing that distinguished the United States from Canada, which I can speak in detail about comparing the two countries and looking back that the two countries were founded under very different circumstances, different culture. Very, very different, I would say, as a Canadian. A lot of people outside, they might look at Canadians, Americans, and think, oh, there's not much of a difference. Well, yeah, that may be the case post-1960s era. Of course, there's still some big differences, even despite that. But so the independent livelihood, that was a big thing. The whole frontier culture was another aspect as well. And you also look to the case of that there was Kyle, are you still there? I actually heard a drop off there. Okay, yeah, Kyle may have been cut off.
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, yeah, so there was the frontier culture, and there was the rugged individualism as well. There was the Protestant work ethic. And so these are all things then that either exclusively or more so in the United States than was in the case in Canada. And so then you had this revolution, and a big thing also was the whole militia movement of the colonies at the time. And this is something that you just didn't have in Canada to that any extent whatsoever of that kind. So there are very important differences, but this is exactly what led to the revolution. And, you know, interesting, there's some people like Gary North from the Austrian school who would say, well, that was really not good of them to go and revolt against the king, because they only had like the second lowest tax rate in the world. Maybe Britain was had the lowest, and so it wasn't really worth revolting over. Well, I think there's more to life than just about the tax base that you pay. And so this was over ideology. This was about that no individual has to go and bow to any other person as a sovereign. This is what the real issue is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem like the American Revolution was very much, or it could very much be considered something of a libertarian, with a lowercase L so that it's not associated with Lou Rockwell, a libertarian revolt. And you can look at different quotes. You mentioned Jefferson, and he said, "A wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, which shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government, and this is necessary to close the circle of our felicities." And I think that sounds pretty damn good to me. Now, a lot of people question whether or not the American Revolution was really a just cause, or whether or not there were different hidden forces at play to create something that was not beneficial to the people in America. And that's not really where I want to go tonight. But do you think that the revolution was, in some ways, a desire to also just decouple from the Bank of England and being tied to their monetary system? It seems like the taxes and just being subservient to England, economically speaking, was the driving motivation here.
Yes, that it was economics, because of there were the two stamp acts, and one of the big things was that there was the law then that actually prohibited the colonies then from issuing their own currencies, and also that going and requiring the payment of the duties in gold. And this is what you see time and time again over the course of several hundred years here, where they've repeated the pattern of that they always portrayed gold as the big solution to the monetary woes. But that's because it has like a certain value over time that has been the case.
Well, it actually wasn't the first standard. Correct? It was actually silver.
Right. Yeah.
It was a silver standard to begin with in the United States.
Well, you did have the dollar, at least when you had the United States, the dollar is defined as a certain number of grains of silver. And so you did have a conversion standard there in terms of what the ratio was. And I believe it was 15 to 1, then that gold was worth more than the silver. And it changed, then they refixed it at 16 to 1. And it had been actually when they said the Hunt brothers had bought up all these futures contracts and driven the price of silver up to $50. And then you had gold up to $850. So it was to a similar ratio in that case. And so, but right now, obviously, there's a big gap between the price of gold and silver. But yeah, it was about economics. In the mass media, they'll put it out. Yeah, it was about the tax on tea. That was a big thing that started it. But the monetary system was a big thing. And you see the proof of the breakaway originally from the Bank of England, which was, it wasn't the first central bank, but it was right after the one they had in Sweden, I think. And it was in the late 1600s, and the privately owned, that was the big distinction of it.
And how did that come to be? This is, of course, the famous story of Napoleon's defeat, correct?
Yes, in Waterloo. And the thing is, actually, this gets to a point of where I started finding out the different stories that were repeated in the alternative media, that there was another, at least, perspective to it, if not the overriding perspective, is that I had read that apparently, I have to check more of the sources because I didn't look too deeply into it at the time, but like the whole narrative goes that you actually had the Rothschilds put out false information saying that Napoleon had won that battle, and then saying that they cashed in on the stocks, that they knew it would go down, so they bought them up. They were all ready to go and buy up the stocks at bargain bin prices, and then the real thing came out that Napoleon was defeated, so then their stock price went up. Now I later heard that has not been substantiated, so that's something I need to look into more. But it's the fact of the matter is that the warfare, the big thing is economics, and disinformation is the big thing, as we see today. So much, this is something that I'm really interested in researching in the alternative media, is about the monetary disinformation that is right throughout the alternative media.
Well, there is a motto of a certain intelligence organization out there, and it roughly translates to, by way of deception, thou shalt wage war. And I think that you're spot on. The economic disinformation that is out there is part of this overall warfare campaign. And, of course, there are people out there that want us to think that we've got Nazi bankers running the world. So it certainly is quite a bit of disinformation we do have to deal with. And I was always a little bit suspect of that story, just about how easily Rothschild was able to take over the Bank of England, just gain all of the power of the country. It seemed like there was something else taking place, but regardless of what actually happened, it does look like the monetary control in England, which was incredibly important and was going to become even more important in coming centuries, was basically transferred over to the House of Rothschild. And this is what it seems the American patriots were revolting against. And it seemed that they had some very justified grievances. And so let's move forward a bit. After the successful revolution in the United States, we talked about the silver standard, but one of the big battles that took place was between people who wanted a strong central government, and this is still taking place today, and people who wanted states' rights, and for the federal government to basically get their noses out of everybody's business. One of the people very much on the side of big government was Alexander Hamilton, and also a big proponent of the first central bank of the country. Is that correct?
Yes, that, as it turned out, he actually basically wanted a type of monarchy then for the U.S. And then he was one of the big writers then of the Federalist Papers, where they used the pen names because they actually didn't want to know who they were. But I think there was a very big difference then between John Jay, James Madison, and what Alexander Hamilton had in mind. Because then once he got in power as the head of the Treasury, then he went and reversed his position on a few important things. And, well, one of them is that I think that he certainly didn't write about it in the Federalist Papers, about Congress having the power to go and charter a privately owned central bank, at least 80% owned, which is what he pushed for. And as it turned out that actually Thomas Jefferson had just written a very small thing to Washington, not too many words, about saying why it wasn't necessary. But I'm sure that Hamilton kind of, the way things work as a lawyer, unfortunately, you have to go and write a whole bunch of words, and it can be more convincing to some rather than making a really simple argument, like James Madison, for instance, just talking about how that the powers of the federal government are few and defined, that if the government had more than the powers that were enumerated, then the enumeration of those powers would basically be useless. That should be all it takes to drive the point home about that it doesn't list in there that they have the power to create a central bank that's privately owned. But the thing is that they do have the power to go and carry out those laws. So this is where it was being argued by Hamilton then that Congress did have the power. And then Washington was just convinced by Hamilton in that case to go and sign in the First Bank of the United States. Actually, under the Articles of Confederation, they had also had a privately owned bank, the Bank of North America as well. But the proof of that they wanted to get away from Britain was in the Article of Confederation as well, where the states were issuing their own money, which was a holdover from what the colonies had already been doing. And then even with under the Constitution, and then with the colonial script, this was also under the Articles of Confederation, the colonial script was issued as well, and that was issued completely interest-free. And they didn't have to borrow that into existence. That was issued by the Congress. But then what happened is this is where you had Alexander Hamilton there saying that, oh, Congress does have the power. And it's just blatantly unconstitutional because Congress has the power to coin money. Now there's the argument as to whether coin money means to strike from a coin or to create money. And the thing is that the Constitution prohibits the states from going and coining money and emitting bills of credit, but it does not prohibit the federal government from doing so. But the thing is that you could, just the way the states are, it's admitted that they can constitutionally have a bank that issues credit. I think the same case could be made for Congress, provided that it pays for the actual powers. But the important point is it can't be privately owned. That'd be the same thing as having the power of war officially being given to some private consortium. It's no different. This is what the coining of money, but it's even more blatant because they're not even coining money in this bank. They were just going and issuing these bills of credit.
You're saying instead of going to Congress to declare war, which doesn't even happen anymore with all the military ventures, instead we just give that power over to Blackwater or Xi,
right,
or Academy or whoever it is now. Yeah. Well, that did not last long. The First Bank of the United States, it was Jefferson who squashed it, correct?
Actually, I think it ended by itself. He was in there during that time when it ended.
Okay.
But Congress just didn't renew it, the first one, yeah.
And then it came back into existence. I don't remember exactly when, but it was Jackson who considered it the pinnacle of his career to get rid of what he considered the den of vipers.
Yes, and that's what he ran his reelection campaign on, that he would go and kill that second Bank of the United States. And, yeah, that whole vipers thing, that I think it actually goes back to, well,
the vipers of Venice, correct? I've heard about this, the vipers of Venice, and I think I've heard you mention it. Could you elaborate a bit upon just who these vipers are?
Well, actually, I was going to mention that I think it even goes back to the Bible and about this is at least now I don't actually, in my case, think that the book of Revelation is actually talking about some future event, but I think it's actually talking about a past event where they're writing about it after the fact. But I think that actually the mention of the vipers and about the Satan, the devil, and the serpent, I think that is actually referring to the apostate Jewish leadership. And because there's actually different things that you can find in the Bible where it's going referring to vipers, and that's actually referring to the different apostate leadership at the time. It was the Hebrews and then the Jews mentioned in the New Testament. But I think that was that was part of it, because there's the word in Hebrew, which actually, the word actually talking about usury is the word like a bite. So there's the actual biblical reference of Hebrew there, of the bite. So I think he was actually deliberately, but he had to do it in a clever way. He was referring to the Jewish usurers.
Well, you do have the symbol for the dollar, which is basically a snake coiling itself around a rod. And actually, if you take the word money and you reverse it, you get yenum. And Y, as a letter, is made up of the V on top of an I. So pretty much you could interpret that as venom. Money backwards is venom. And you look at the way that the U.S. dollar has encircled the globe and pretty much restricted our productivity in many ways, it does seem like some kind of large boa constrictor. And whoa, actually, boa, B-O-A, Bank of America, boa. Isn't that interesting? There definitely does seem to be a whole lot of connections here, and I would not be surprised if Jackson was using some coded language to get his message across. But let's move on from there. How did the United States fare after having the second bank dispatched?
Yeah, when they got rid of it. Well, there was a shortage of money, actually, because this is where Jackson actually supported a gold standard. And so because of gold being limited in quantity, and this is back when they actually would use like more than just a really tiny portion to actually physically go and settle their exchanges in gold. And so it was a twofold thing, that you did have this drop in credit because of getting rid of the bank and then any sort of affiliations with that bank. Actually, there's really three aspects, because there was another aspect of that the bank, under the head of the bank, actually before the bank was killed, actually intentionally went and restricted the money supply in order to try to get Jackson out of there, but or at least to make it very unappealing for him to try and go and kill the bank. If they could like blame, oh, like killing the bank, it'll make it even worse. And then there was that aspect of Jackson favoring a gold standard. But actually, right after that period, though, when it went back to free enterprise, which is really the only time that the United States under the Constitution did have a period of real free enterprise, of having no central bank whatsoever, it's actually the best growth period of the United States ever.
Mm-hmm.
All the way up until the time of Lincoln.
Well, yes, the Civil War added a whole lot of new complexity to the economic issues of the United States. And famous are Lincoln's greenbacks that he used to finance the war. Do you care to comment upon that at all?
Yes. Now, this is where I then found out in the past 2 years here some additional information, which kind of changes an alternative narrative to the narrative about gold. So the thing is that it is the case, so Congress, like there are called the Lincoln Greenbacks, but through an act of Congress then, which was signed by Lincoln, that there were several hundred million of the greenbacks that were issued, which was a lot during that time. And I think I ran the calculations. I think it was at least over 10% of the total money supply at its height, to get an idea of the perspective. Like right now, several hundred million is like nothing, and it actually has more collector value. But at the time, that's very significant, especially when they weren't borrowing so much money. At the time, it was actually, you could have a solvent government, and the government was fairly well within its range, except for all those excesses and violations, just for the sake of preserving the union, as it were. But so they were issued without borrowing it from any private entity. That was one thing. And then actually, now this is where it gets into a little bit of a disagreement as to whether there was interest attached to them, because not directly, but it was the case of they were issued as part of a package where they could be converted to some bonds where you could actually go and get interest on that. But the thing is, I looked up the numbers, that most of that was not converted into the bonds. So you did have those bonds being issued, but in a way that was really separate, with the majority of them not being converted. Actually, I think it was the overwhelming majority of them were not actually, people did not go and redeem them in bonds. So they were effectively like over 80% serving interest free And so this was a big thing, that this was a big challenge to the money power. And now this gets to where that probably is not an accurate quote, where it's mentioned about the banker circulation saying about, oh, like this is like a big problem for us if this ever happened, that we basically be out of business. That apparently cannot be verified, that thing, but that you can stand by, the history stands by that being the thing, because this is the whole struggle over the past 400 years and even longer than that. But looking at with England and the United States and the pre-time of the United States of like 400 years in England, is that with the whole Bank of England, is that this has been the whole struggle over the private banking interest versus the public the public government being able to issue money without borrowing it and without any interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the Civil War, a great period of despair for many, but others profited immensely. And this then brings us up to the turn of the century, going into the 1900s. There was some turmoil in the world. There were a few, you know, there's the Spanish-American War, a few other military adventures, but the big one, the big number one, was World War One. And for the United States to be able to enter this war, it seemed like what was necessary was the third and perhaps final central bank of the United States. It needed to come into existence. So you had Woodrow Wilson basically selling his country, his people, and all future generations down the river, selling them into slavery, and then getting the American people involved in a fratricidal war that would set the stage for the Second World War. And so what I'm referring to, of course, in 1913 would be the passage of the 16th Amendment, which was the income tax, and you also had the Federal Reserve Act, which created the Federal Reserve, which has printed all of our notes today. And from the beginning, it seems that this was Jewish. Just coincidentally, also, in 1913, is the year that the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, was formed. So in the same year that Jewish interests take pretty much complete control of America's money supply, they also make it a big offense to even criticize anyone who's Jewish. I just think that's pretty interesting. But could you comment upon this time period? We've heard all about the creature from Jekyll Island, which is where where this was cooked up. And the Federal Reserve Act had failed previously in Congress, it seems, under the name of, what was that man's name?
Aldrich.
Yeah, the Aldrich Plan. And they had repackaged it, and the big banks apparently came out against the Federal Reserve Act, saying, oh, no, you can't do this to us. But it was just a big show. It was deception to get people to think that if the banks don't like it, then it must be good for us. And so there was some support for the Federal Reserve Act as compared to the Aldrich Plan. Yeah. Have we been told some lies about this, or what have you come to find out about this important time?
Yeah, so to clear up two misconceptions that had been running pretty rampant ever since I had been following the alternative media in 2006 was that the claim that there was a vote during Christmas, on the eve of Christmas, and that they didn't have quorum there, which actually at least, in both chambers, the House and the Senate, you need to have 50% actually, and this is what's so blatant now. Actually, a lot of the laws are unconstitutional because they don't have that 50% of the actual members of half of the 435 in the House or half of the senators there. But that is actually not the case about the claim that they had this vote without quorum on the eve of Christmas. They actually did have a vote just before that time, where they did actually have the appropriate quorum. So that So that bill actually was passed. Of course, this gets to some people claiming, well, the records were doctored, but you can't go and prove a negative. And so, and then the other thing is that the claim that there was some 99 or 100 year charter, and I had just looked into that and found out that actually the Congress had changed the law in 1927. Originally, it was actually a 20 year charter, which is what the first two banks had. Interesting how they actually had charters for some of these private corporations in the past, but then they made it indefinite after 1927. And then again, that's where some people say, well, we can't trust the records there. They've been doctored. But I just find that to be completely unproductive, because it actually distracts away from the main issue, is that Congress could go and kill the Federal Reserve anytime it wanted to. So you don't need to worry about whether some charter that exists or not is being honored. But the thing is that, yeah, there was this big Jewish presence, even though you'll have Edward Griffin talking about, oh, well, there was J.P. Morgan in that. But you look, this is where Eustace Mullins was correct. That now some people are passing this off to this very day, or especially in the past couple of years, I noticed, oh, here's who owns the Federal Reserve. Actually, it was referring to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, one of the 12 regional banks, but the most powerful, obviously, because the center of Wall Street and the economic capital of the United States, and the rival to London. And so the thing is also that, so it is the most powerful bank, overwhelmingly so. And, but that it actually, his list was accurate at the time in terms of when the Federal Reserve was created. You name all those Jewish banks. Now, the thing is that there were these Jewish banks because that there was quote unquote discrimination by the WASPs and the Catholics, who actually, some of them then who were in banking, this is the whole claim. Oh, there was discrimination. But so that was an aspect, quote unquote, discrimination. But you just go down the list and it's like Lazard Frere Brothers talking about the current banks there. I'm trying to think of the Lehman Brothers is mentioned. And then you have the Goldman Sachs, and there's a few others there which are just unmistakably Jewish. And you can actually tied to some of the representatives there who were at Goldman Sachs. So yeah, even though there wasn't really the big Jewish takeover in the United States until, like, with the media, like starting especially in the late 20s and then in the 30s. But yeah, this is the thing. There was a big, huge Jewish presence in the banking system, even before then, obviously, that they weren't able to go and create all this money and create these banks overnight. But this is the thing. The big thing is, and here's why it's a problem. It's like why Kevin McDonald mentioned, because like Jews as a group overall, but you have this Jewish elite that they're hostile. They're hostile to the overwhelmingly, it was a white Christian. And, of course there were like different, people who weren't so much following the Christian orthodoxy in that, but this is what you had. And the Protestants were the dominant group. And so these Jewish elite, they were hostile to the mainstream America. This is what the whole problem was. And so, and it goes back to, and to their Bible, this is where that is no longer, this is the thing that it said, like the Christians at least are not supposed to be going and taking usury from anyone actually. But in the case of that, the Old Testament, that it says, and this is what the Jews are supposed to be following, that's the most authentic thing, that they don't say that the Torah is no longer valid whatsoever, even though that so many of them don't even believe in God, which is quite odd. But the thing is that they, right in there, it says that they're supposed to go and take usury from non-Hebrews, in this case, non-Jews. And so this is a big factor of why it becomes a big problem of having this small group that's hostile to the interests of the entire nation.
Well, there's the quote from Deuteronomy 15, verse 6. This is from the King James Version here. For the Lord thy God blesseth thee, as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow, and thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee. And this does seem like the setup that the Jews have been able to accomplish by using the WASPs. They didn't let them know that they were waging war against them, because then they would be overwhelmed. the Jews would lose. There were too many wasps, and they were too powerful. So instead, they sought to kind of weasel their way or slither their way into different centers of control, namely the economic centers, but then later into the minds of the people through their mass media. And this is what really sealed the deal for what we see today, the lack of resistance to their complete domination. But let's continue on in this timeline just a little bit, and we get to, of course, there's the Great Depression, the crash of the stock market. Actually, let's just touch upon this for a second. Have you looked into this time period, and have we been fed some lies about what really caused the big stock market crash and the different factors involved?
So one of the official narratives then is, well, that there was this big run-up in credit, and then because you didn't have the regulations, that then suddenly, because of this over-speculation, there was this huge correction, and this is what happens with an unchecked market. But, I mean, there were a certain amount of regulations, not to the degree that they have now, because this was then before the time that they had the Securities and Exchange Commission, where now suddenly Congress purported to have the power to go and regulate the stock trades, even though they had never claimed that power before directly in such a way. And the thing, basically my point is that I don't agree with the full mass media narrative put out there, that I think there was this whole issue of the credit. But my big exception with it is that they don't go and point out that it was the very nature of the monetary system that was in place because of usury. Actually, that's the real big elephant in the room that they don't talk about in the official narrative. That's what really led to it, along with the whole moral thing as well, that this is what happens if you have enough of an unregulated market. Like, this is where the second president had mentioned about how that the Constitution was for a moral and religious people, and it wouldn't work for anyone else. So this is where, and the specific reason why he mentioned that is because that if you give the power through the Constitution, that you actually could go and take some money. It wasn't supposed to be directly through the income tax, but you could, at least through the excise taxes, go and take money from some group of people and give it to others, that it required a moral people to not go and use that in a confiscatory way and to just go and steal the fruits of labor from others.
Well, it seems like this calamity was engineered. To me, because of the way that power was seized afterward, it seemed like they set this up so that they could then grind the people under their boot. And you look at what FDR did in his New Deal and his various plans to revive the American economy. You had farmers killing livestock in some harebrained plan to increase the price of meat for butchers or whatever the case may be. I forget that exact story. So they had plans in place where they had food, but because of their economic advisors, they were destroying it because, oh, that would be what's good for the economy. What's good for the people. This really goes to show you the Jewish brain. But it does have correlations, it seems, to what was going on, say, in Ukraine around this time period with the mass starvation, the Holodomor. And the powers that the federal government received because of this crisis were immense. FDR had a third term. That's one of the things that was just kind of thrown, one of the basic parts of American, the American executive branch, that was just thrown out the window. We need FDR as something of a king in here. And, well, he made it illegal to own gold. At least that's what I've read. And so gold was confiscated at the set price that the federal government said it would be traded in for. So there was a lot of shenanigans going on at that time because of what seems to be an engineered crisis. Now, it doesn't even matter if it was an engineered crisis. Just as Rahm Emanuel said, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah, well, I think it was very revealing about that, that actually FDR was not happy with the only Bill of Rights that exists in the United States, where there's nothing that's owed to you other than that the government is supposed to protect your rights. But he actually used the whole Great Depression to support what he pitches his new Bill of Rights, where that suddenly you had the right, all these positive rights, so-called, where the government was supposed to provide all these things for you, which is communism, at least socialism that would eventually lead to communism, of the total control of the economy through the state. And so that's the thing, at least that his whole ideology, and it's amazing, you see this through the LaRouche group, especially, like, they'll go and praise FDR as being so great. Well, he turned around the economy. Well, you can say that, like, certain people, like, turned the things around, but that it depends how they did it. And so when I found out about that whole new Bill of Rights, like, that was very revealing then about that, just completely anti-American in terms of the whole things, the recipe that made the United States so great, along with it had great geography, especially in the people, but there was that whole aspect of the government, which was integral to the success that the U.S. did have, and he wanted to go in reverse. And you see this to the very day with Obama, just as the latest incarnation of someone who wants, like you talk about grinding America down with the Obamacare, is like a modern-day example of what you would see with FDR, with the kind of things he did during the Great Depression.
Yeah, the Affordable Health Care Act, which will increase your health care costs threefold. How about that? And we'll call it the Affordable Health Care Plan. Wow. Thanks, Obama. Thanks, Jews. Incredible. So FDR, in the 1930s, did a number of different things. One of those was in 1933 was the Glass-Steagall Act. It was the Banking Act of 1933. And this is what first started decoupling the U.S. dollar from the gold standard. Is this correct?
Well, just before that, like you had mentioned about how FDR did go and confiscate beyond, it was the value of the time was beyond like about 4 ounces of non-numismatic, meaning non-collector gold that you could still retain, which is the overwhelming amount of gold. And then there's different stories as to whether like it was only 10% of people actually returned that. So, but that was before that whole Glass-Steagall thing. That was the start of it. That was the Glass-Steagall thing was kind of independent of that, but it was like a big separation away from the system that they had beforehand. But like with Glass-Steagall, I think it represents an important principle, and this is where you would have, well, obviously all the anarchists would disagree with Glass-Steagall, but this is where actually you have most of the Austrian school and even most of the libertarians perhaps might say, no, Glass-Steagall was no good at all because the government has no basis like going and regulating these things. Well, it's the whole issue is that it's about your property that you go and deposit in the banks. And like for the same reason that even though he's an anarchist, not that it's really relevant in this case, if I think about it, of trying to relate it to his anarchism, but just to point out, Walter Block makes the point that actually that fractional reserve banking where you're going and lending out money that you do not have, that is fraud. And the reason why is because even though you go and call it a deposit, but it's functioning as a lottery ticket. So in the same way, even though Walter Block and all these other guys wouldn't support my contention here about Glass-Steagall being valid, but I see the same thing applying, is that that's your deposit there. And what Glass-Steagall is doing is saying that the banks cannot go and take that money and go and speculate with it on their own investments because it represents, in this case, a breach of the fiduciary duty to go and protect that money. And again, using similar reasoning that's supposed to function as your deposit, but then if it's serving as an investment, then it's actually a fraud of a contract, and all frauds and contracts are invalid. So I fully stand behind the principle of Glass-Steagall, and it was very important because it did go and put a limitation on the kind of speculation, but it was relevant to the gold standard in that prior to 1933, well, during later on in 1933, that the banks had to have like 40% of all the dollars had to be backed up by a certain amount of gold. So that was restraining in terms of what they had. Actually, that was one of the problems, was that they couldn't just go and create money, as it were. They would have been able to keep their little scam going longer, but the gold actually went and brought the problem on even sooner.
Mm-hmm. Well, during this same time period, while the United States was wallowing in depression, National Socialist Germany had pulled itself up by the bootstraps and was seeing unprecedented success. Most of the world was in some form of depression, except the NSDAP had turned things around and had a booming economy. And this is the economic reasons. World War II happened mainly because of economic reasons. And you can look at various quotes by Winston Churchill and others saying exactly that they had to crush the economic success of Germany. But maybe we can keep it on America for right now, and we can touch upon the Third Reich and their economic system in just a little bit. Let's fast forward to try to get through this history and bring it up to the present day. Let's talk about Bretton Woods and what that did.
So in 1946, then it was this whole plan after the end of World War II to go and reorder the whole monetary system of the world, and it was ultimately leading towards a world financial system, which they had already had certain aspects of that with the pound, the sterling pound, and then with the rise of the United States becoming a big military power then on its own, and ultimately being, well, at least the victor relative to Britain and that. And so what happened was that they were going to have some fixed exchange rates between the different currencies. And then the other thing was that the U.S. dollar would be the next big power there. And then eventually that whole thing was, at that point even right there, was tied into, after they had discovered oil in Saudi Arabia in the 30s, that the U.S. dollar then was going to be the world reserve currency, and it would actually be the petrodollar. That would be the new backing to replace gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then those fixed exchange rates went and fell apart. And then another big thing was in 1971, where they call it closing the gold window of Nixon, at least issued the order for that, of that Charles de Gaulle went and requested France went and requested.
Yeah, it was de Gaulle.
Yeah, went and requested the gold instead of the U.S. dollars that they're holding on to. They wanted the gold based upon $35 an ounce. Actually, then the IMF had like a separate value, which is still in the books today, like $40. But around that area, wanted to exchange it for that. And then they said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And this is where it's pitched. Oh, it's good to have gold backing up the monetary supply because it stops governments, keeps them on it so that way they don't spend beyond their means. Well, that didn't stop Nixon and all the enablers behind him from going and just throwing that out the window when they wanted. This is actually a big problem with the so-called gold standard that people push. Oh, it's going to limit them so much, and it never does because it's just a piece of paper for them. Ultimately, they can throw it out the window whenever they want, just as they had done domestically in 1933, where that was an exchange standard. Well, the same thing, but it was for the U.S. populace itself versus internationally. So that's when there was considered the final decoupling of the U.S. dollar from gold. And then, of course, you look at with all the socialism overall that they brought in, that's where you notice this huge exponential debt curve in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually where that people will try to, some of the Austrians would say, well, that's the whole problem with getting rid of the gold standard. That's what really led to it. but they don't want to talk about usury and the fact about how it's actually the usury that it mathematically will exponentially increase the amount of debt that is owed. And that's actually the real problem, not about whether there's a gold standard or not.
Let's move to the early 80s. You had mentioned it earlier. The Hunt brothers cornered the silver market, and they drove the price up almost fourfold, or even more, actually, in just the period of a few years, and or even less. And they were doing this completely legitimately, by the books. And the Fed was, I think the Fed had to step in and basically change the rules. Could you elaborate upon this a bit? And do you think that this was an important event that was, well, it, I think it did shape the minds of many people at that point, and did set something of a precedent. And it is interesting that those Hunts, at least one of them, went on and was very involved in the John Birch Society. And I do think that is definitely a form of controlled opposition there. But could you just comment a bit on that event and what that really meant?
Yeah, I actually heard then an alternative narrative about that, which is that there is this whole narrative put out there that, oh, these evil Hunt brothers, like, went and cornered the market on silver. And actually, I've heard that challenged on two different points. Actually, someone had inspired me to get into all this and had a radio show himself for several years about all these little discussed issues about alternative economics. Had actually inspected, he said himself, these contracts, and then found out that actually they hadn't cornered the silver market in terms of what that would really involve in order to be able to claim to have done that. But the raw deal was that suddenly, yeah, they came in with whatever regulatory agency it was, and they said that there could be no buyers now, and they actually had to retroactively go and sell based on a certain price. So since there were no buyers, there was no one to, like, come in there. And so that's what actually crashed the value. So it's completely anti-free market. So regardless of anyone would point to, oh, well, the Hunt brothers did this particular thing, but that pales in comparison to what was done by the hands of the government. So it's just a heavy-handed thing. And this is actually one aspect of it, is that the message is put out there that, yeah, you won't actually be able to, well, even though the market was rigged, certainly by the 80s to an extent, but yeah, like, you're not going to be able, as like some family, to be able to make a whole bunch of money and get a big stake in any particular market, commodity market, or whatever it is, through the rules that we have set up, will crush you. And the only way that anyone's going to be able to make off like in a big heist is if they're part of our little system here directly. Mm-hmm. And through the government, of course, is how it's done.
Okay, well, there were some wars going on in the 80s after this. You had wars in the 90s, and there's turmoil. The 80s was a very interesting time, economically speaking, where some people were making out like bandits, but for many people it seemed like it could be the end of the world at any given time. So there was a bit of uncertainty, that's for sure, and when there are periods of chaos and uncertainty, there are some people who are very much able to capitalize off of this. But let's try to end up this part of the discussion in the next few minutes here. But let's go to 1999 with the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, so what you had there was the Senator Jesse Helms, the great senator from the South there, who was a big sponsor of that whole thing. And I think, well, there was Phil Graham, too, as well, I think. And the whole issue there was that, and you got to love the titles, of course, they used, like the Patriot Act, which is an acronym for the name of the legislation. But, like, it's the Modernization Act, right? So who would want to be against modernizing things? And what it did was that opened the door then that it was in the shadow market, as of these credit default swaps, the unregulated insurance policies on the so-called investments, and on like mortgages where the mortgage-backed securities, those insurance policies for the mortgages specifically. And so they were existing, but it was small. But what this did was this said that, yeah, we're not going to regulate this whatsoever. So that codified the non-regulation of it, which is interesting because there's all these other regulations on all the markets and that. But this goes directly back to, this was something that Alan Greenspan knew that they needed, that he needed to go and pump up the whole system after what happened in the 80s. But then you can only run the whole real estate thing of, oh, the real estate starts going up. And then, so we need to pump things up even bigger. So that Greenspan was a big part of that. And of course, the whole Federal Reserve overall was a big thing as a result of him being the chairman, and all the banks were in favor of that as well, because why would they want any regulations that to stop them from going and doing whatever? But it created a big problem because you had these insurance companies out there for all different kinds of insurance, life insurance, car insurance, and probably even on the different investments, that they're all subject to these, well, in some cases, stringent regulations. And then you have all this other stuff, which isn't primarily through the investment banks. But then, of course, getting rid of Glass-Steagall then suddenly allowed the deposit banks into it, too. That was the other big thing. So now the deposit banks, not only are they allowed to speculate, but they can do it with these unregulated insurance policies, and unregulated in terms of you don't have to have any capital requirements whatsoever, that you could have, like they talked about, a quadrillion possibly of these derivatives that were out there.
So essentially what happened at that point was that the private and the public sort of merged in some regards. Am I getting that correct?
More of a merger. Yeah, because, of course, like you were talking about before with the Federal Reserve then, about, like, in 1913,
right,
and about how there was the governmental aspect, but there was the private aspect as well. And then, yeah, with Glass-Steagall then going and having the government, but to regulate it. But, yeah, it was the merging in terms of just more deliberately the banksters more overtly going and running the whole financial system, that they're the experts, so they get to make all the regulations even more so, right? At least like Glass-Steagall, you show, oh, this actually would benefit the people, and it stayed tried and true. It wasn't a complete solution because you still have the matter of usury, but that's the thing. It wasn't under Glass-Steagall that the whole thing collapsed. That you would have had a reckoning sooner, but it wouldn't have been as big, because and it wouldn't have been as dangerous too.
Now, this event has been blamed for the 2008 crisis, the crash. Do you think that this was the main event that you could pinpoint that really set off this chain of events, or was it a variety of factors that led up to the 2008 crisis? Well, you could also consider all of the war expenditures and all sorts of other things that were going on at that time, but what's your opinion on that? Was the repeal of Glass-Steagall the main event that led up to the crash?
I'd say in combination with that, about just that the kind of credit default swaps, these unregulated insurance policies that were being promoted out there, that was the big event if you want to point to what led to 2008. And the thing is that, but there were the other aspects as well, that you had that around 50% of all the mortgages were held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were considered quasi-governmental agencies. But then you had this whole moral hazard where the government was, oh, well, in order to deal with these racial and economic inequalities related to race and with the social system, that we need to go and give these mortgages to minority groups who, well, in some cases, not black people, but other people will eventually become the majority the way the current trends are going. But this is like, oh, we need to help them out, and we need to give them mortgages that they wouldn't otherwise qualify for. And this was a thing. At least this is what the subprime thing was all about. But then, as it was pointed out, that when Hank Paulson, former head of Goldman Sachs, said that, yeah, we need this $700 billion here and that actually, they said it would have actually paid off the subprime, but it was a bait and switch that he actually wanted to go and bail out the banks instead. And then everyone's acting so shocked that he actually went and did that after the fact, even though they didn't put any stipulations in there to say that it had to go and pay for it. So if you look at the total dollar value, then it wasn't so much related to the subprime thing. But that the big thing that was like an aspect that fed into it. It was just completely wrong for the government to be engaged in that. Like, you didn't have that going on in Canada. Of course, you don't have the kind of racial problems that in Canada that are in the United States, but with Canada becoming increasingly diverse, but still the government, interesting enough, being more centralized, was not involved in that in Canada the way it was in the U.S. But the big thing was those derivatives. We're talking like several hundreds of trillions or quadrillion. And you just look to the specific thing, what happened, like Lehman Brothers, a Jewish bank, at least with starting and certainly the top executives of there, just overwhelmingly Jewish, the head of it. But this is interesting about how they were on the outs. Goldman Sachs was the big Jewish bank that had all the favors within the U.S. government, that Lehman Brothers actually, I think, like so many of these Goldman Sachs people actually hated the head of Lehman Brothers, and there was the big rivalry between them. But that's the thing. These other banks got bailouts, or like with Bear Stearns was purchased by Bank of America. And another thing is that, yeah, you had so this whole special favoritism that you had, but then the other thing was AIG and a Jewish head of that. I'm sure that's just complete coincidental, of that this was where it like bailed out to the tune of like $180 billion at least. And that's where actually it was AIG that had the really big derivative liability. And they say that if they hadn't bailed out AIG, that there was so many intricacies, tie-ins with all these other banks and the commercial banks, that if they hadn't bailed them out, like the whole banking system would have gone under. But yeah, I think the derivative thing related to the termination of Glass-Steagall, that was the biggest factor relating to that.
And you had huge bonuses being given out at this time as well. People are losing their jobs all around the country. And these bankers who had committed all sorts of fraud with what they were doing, at least that's how I see it. Maybe you don't consider it fraud. Would you consider what they were doing fraud?
Oh, yes, because that's the thing, is they only went and prosecuted and actually successfully convicted some people who on insider trading charges. So I would definitely consider those credit defaults actually are fraud, but specifically with the subprime ones, because that's like having like AAA beef but you're mixing in some adulterated beef in there and you're still calling it AAA. It's the same analogy I see, because they were literally, oh, well, if you go and break up enough mortgages, maybe like one of them. And the thing is, they didn't even know in some cases which ones were the bogus mortgages. It was divided up. But like, oh, if nine of them are like AAA and then you have like one bogus one, but given this little derivative contract, which some Chinese national guy came up with, who was actually working for one of the banks in Canada when this whole thing blew up, and then he disappeared out of Canada as fast. But this guy created this little formula that they were using, saying like, oh, there's no problem that all these derivatives can go up in value. But the thing is that it was fraud, because you're having some of them which are not AAA. And even with the whole credit default swaps, again, it's the whole issue of that, well, this is an insurance policy. But is that actually, that's where it's fraud, because it's not an insurance policy, because the insurance there should be some basis behind it. It's a lottery ticket. It's actually functioning as a lottery ticket when there's no regulations, whether it's government regulations or internal ones, of actually saying, no, we have to have some sort of limits and regular checks. It was like they could just do whatever they wanted, and they knew, because they had the connections with the Federal Reserve, could go and bail them out, and with the government and their other banks, that they could just go and bail themselves out eventually. Well, eventually they had to rely on the U.S. taxpayer for that directly.
So it seems that the policy that is in place here with these big Jewish banks is that they have capitalism when they are succeeding, when they're profiting, so they keep it all for themselves. But they want socialism when things go badly. Then they want everybody to bail them out. They're too big to fail. So it's heads I win, tails you lose. Basically, when I'm doing well, I'm going to keep the profits. When I'm doing poorly, you guys have to pitch in. The taxpayer has to pitch in, because this is an issue of, you know, national interest here. And I think it's just sickening to see this, especially when so many people in the country are losing their homes, in fact, to banks who are getting bailed out with U.S. taxpayer dollars. It's terrible. It's awful to see this taking place. And the problem I see is that the whole thing is a little bit too complex for the average American to even understand. These credit default swaps. What was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac doing? Derivatives? What? I don't do calculus. What are you talking about? And they might even know that derivative is a calculus term. But, do you think that this economic catastrophe is just not really fully grasped by the average American, who just basically sees his standard of living going down, his wage going down, and the cost of living going up?
Yeah, I agree with, I think it was Henry Ford who said that if the American people really understood what was going on with the banking system, that there would be a revolution overnight or the next morning. And so there was a lot of confusion out there. They had deliberately went and confused things, that they had changed the definition of subprime. Subprime, at least, yeah, you have to have more than like a grade 3 education to know what it means. But the original definition was that it was something that was below the most highest creditworthiness. But then suddenly changing that subprime basically means that, it's just a little bit below like AAA. So they changed that. And a big thing is, you have within the mass media, but also within the alternative media, is you have the deliberate confusion put out there by people. And of course, with the mass media, you look to CNBC and that, like, yeah, Jim Cramer actually admitting on some web thing about how, we basically rigged the system when I was like some stock trader, but I can say this on the web, but I couldn't say this on television, otherwise I get in big trouble. And it just goes to show how much the media is controlled, and about how they go and have people thinking that, first of all, that, yeah, you have to be one of these big Wall Street traders, be there for like decades before you can really understand what's going on. And you have to have your government license in order to be able to be some trader, and to all these different licensing agencies that they have and the securities regulators that they have, whether it's the stock market or the commodities market. And the biggest thing is, like, these mass media outlets, well, we know who controls them. And the thing is that they present these people as like, they give them so much credibility, but all the credibility should have been lost, especially with guys like Ben Bernanke, with what happened with the whole, well, I wouldn't even say bungling, it was like deliberate on some parts of what happened with when the whole thing blew up.
That Helicopter Ben was man of the year. What is he, Time man of the year, person of the year? He did an amazing job for America. Now, we have people out there that are saying, end the Fed, Alex Jones, Luke Rutkowski, we are change, end the Fed. I've seen Luke, these massive rallies over in Germany, end the Fed rallies, which, you know, I, in some ways that is good. It's good to see that sentiment. I think it is being a bit misdirected, and of course, with Alex Jones, instead of mentioning that you had Greenspan, Jew, Bernanke, Jew, Yellen, Jew, handing out money to all these different banks, which are Jew, he's talking about Germanic death cults. He's talking about the New World Order. He's talking about anything but Jews.
Yeah, and certainly you had, like, the Gentiles then who were involved in it as well, but the big thing is that there is this whole hostile Jewish elite. That's the point to really drive home here, where there's this whole paranoia about all the this persecution and discrimination, and therefore it results in this elite basically they feel they have to go and dominate various industries, banking and the media, in order to protect themselves, so they think. But actually, of course, over all the cases in the countries over the past 2,000 years where they were kicked out, like it shows that it's always taken to the extreme. And when there's eventually the whole gasket goes and breaks, but that's why you have, of course, as you well know, people like Alex Jones out there, let's call him a Shabazz Goy, that are out there to run misdirection. And of course they want to go and frame it as like, oh, you hate Jews. And the biggest thing that they want to conceal is about the Jewish elite, which is doing a disservice to the average Jew.
Yeah. They want us to think that they happen to be Jews. Those people just happen to be Jews. And often implicit in what these characters are saying is that Jews are really just part of the larger white power, white supremacist structure. It's amazing how much of the alternative media actually buys into that line of thinking.
Right, and then you actually have, like, I think it's significant, like one of the organizers of the White Privilege Conference, Abby Ferber, who actually, this is something I tried to cover on my radio show, but actually it wasn't recording that time. And not that I actually think that there was anything related to that, that there's some technical problem even before they knew what I was going to talk about. But so it didn't get recorded. But I actually reading one of her articles, it's just so fascinating. She's talking about, of course, how Jews became white, that admitting that they're not white, but they became that way. But then, of course, it's under the whole false notion of that it's completely a social construct. Like, certainly there are social construct aspects to race that you could talk about, but the overwhelming one is biological. And the whole thing is that she was saying about, oh yeah, like, but we're white now, but we don't, it's not really serving us that way. You know, like it's this thing that was given to us. And therefore we have this big responsibility to all these other non-white groups here. And so that's the thing, but you won't have a discussion about these kind of issues. But basically the thing she was talking about is pointing that they're outsiders overall. That's definitely misdirection for anyone to talk about that Jewish people overall are some part of the white power structure. Those people at very best would misunderstand the history of the past 2,000 years of Europe and the European derived cultures and civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jews are a race when it suits Jews, and they're a religion when it suits Jews. And if you're even to question anything about this, you're an anti-Semite, a neo-Nazi, a racist, xenophobe, a homophobe, whatever you'd like. We could touch upon some of these other characters who you think are running misdirection, but let's talk about one of the big things that they're running misdirection about. And I think that this is the Third Reich and what they were actually able to accomplish with their economic policies, with their social programs. And they were admittedly socialist. It said it right there in the names. But it was a much different flavor of socialism than we've seen in the United States, than we saw in the Soviet Union. What do you think about this general trend now within the alternative media, as you can see on programs like Red Ice, to actually question the official narrative of the concerning World War II and what the National Socialists were all about? Do you think that they actually had a pretty good system that was set up there, and that Jews have basically just gone about a propaganda campaign to defame them for the past 70-plus years?
Well, to her credit, Ellen Brown, who wrote the book Web of Debt, talking about advocating for a public banking solution, although I would disagree with her remedy in terms of saying that these state banks should be able to go and pay for all kinds of socialistic programs. But to her credit, she actually went and talked about the success under the Third Reich with their economic system, with the with the banking system, and so revealingly that she was attacked very prominently by Gary North, who was like trying to bait, playing these dirty tricks of like calling her like Hitler's cheerleader for economics, and trying to give the whole notion that, like trying to put it in people's minds that she was a supporter of all that Hitler, at least in the mass media, is represented to have done overall. Of course, the big thing being the whole Holocaust narrative, the officially approved kosher one, of course, that it, if it disagrees with anything that the ADL, Abe Foxman, the SPLC, and the World Jewish Congress and every other Jewish organization out there, well, then it's not acceptable. If it disagrees with what they get to decide what the official narrative is. But the thing is that she was attacked, so that just goes to show she was getting things out there. And the biggest thing she pointed out was that what they did, they did not eliminate usury overall, but in terms of these debts that had been undertaken and thrust upon them, what happened with the Treaty of Versailles and during the Weimar Republic, that what they did was they decided that they were just going to go and issue these particular notes that would essentially go and pay off the large part of the debt that they had incurred. So they just issued it into the money supply, and then suddenly there wasn't the scarcity that was deliberately inflicted upon Germany then after they had lost the First World War. Mm-hmm. But now actually this gets into another important thing. This is where I tried hosting a debate between Anthony Mitchell's of Real Currencies and Rodney Martin over to the exact extent of what took place during that time. But Anthony did make some important points, which I would like to echo, that under Nazi Germany, well, let's not use that term, but National Socialists, even though they did, that was a misrepresentation. Of course, in the U.S., they did call themselves the party at first, but National Socialist Germany, that they still did have usury with the private banking, so for commercial loans. But actually, an important point is that the rates were pretty low overall, not the kind of ridiculousness that you saw during the 70s and 80s. And this is a thing that still to this very day, even though they redefined usury deliberately to be any amount of interest that doesn't go along with whatever set by law, it used to be that any amount of interest, period. And that's what the Catholic Church upheld until like people like Tom Woods, who's Catholic, comes along and says, oh, well, actually the Catholic Church would never really spoke out much against usury, even though you actually have one pope, one of the popes, I think Alexander II, who actually went and excommunicated a bunch of people for engaging in usury. So who's more authoritative than the pope, at least within Catholic, within their religion. But that was the whole thing, was that they did at least keep the interest rates low. There was that attempt. And I fully understand that you just can't go and eliminate usury. This has been a whole struggle since the dawn of civilization. It goes back to even before there were Hebrews, is that was there in Babylon. Well, actually, of course, then there's the whole Bible narrative about them being over there in Babylon.
The captivity.
Some point in time.
Yeah. The Babylonian Talmud.
With the Jews, yeah, at that time. But even like talking about with Hammurabi's code, and how it's just ever since Sumer and ever since there was civilization, there was always the problem of usury. So you can't completely go and eliminate it overnight.
Well, it depends on who's lending the money and how they act, to be honest, because I could lend somebody money, and if they're not able to pay me, I'm not going to demand that pound of flesh like a Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. You know, that's the way that these people act. They are ruthless. They are cunning. And they are willing to see you die just so that they can have some more shekels. And this is codified into their holy books. This is how they live. You are their goyim, their slaves, their cattle. And I think that this is obviously very important for us to understand if we're going to find out the truth in this truth movement. Now, let's talk about this very important issue of multiculturalism, diversity in quotation marks, of course, that was thrust upon the European peoples after White War II, otherwise known in common discussion as World War II. All European lands, for the most part, or lands occupied by Europeans, were flooded after World War II. This is ramped up in recent years, but Jews seem to have been behind much of it. They despise the European people. They despise them for their beauty, their health, their way of life. So they have sought to corrupt and subvert and ultimately to destroy. And that's why you have all of this race mixing programming. This is why we have all sorts of incentives for illegal immigrants to flood into European lands, into America, into Australia, and wherever else, into Canada. And a lot of people, because they have been raised with the Jewish media, think that this is just grand. This is just the way it's supposed to be. They don't really even know anything other than this multicultural paradise. And speaking out on this issue is bound to get you labeled all sorts of different pejoratives, which have, of course, been thrown at me, white supremacists being one of the most common. How have you been received when dealing with any of these issues? And also, do you deal with these issues very frequently on your blog? And do you still do a radio show? Do you discuss it there?
Yeah, my radio show has been very sparse over the past few months because I've been busy in my own personal life. But going back at least a couple of years ago, I was very much directly addressing the Zionist issue on my site, and then started being more overt about the Jewish issue as well. But then, like in my comments on different sites or on some of the other interviews, then where the occasion arose, like I really like to get into those issues where it's very relevant to the topic at hand, especially when there's like a deliberate cover-up taking place by so many of the mass media hosts and even a bunch of the alternative media hosts to one extent or another. And so, but the big thing is since about the summer of last year is when I really started having like a different perspective, being pro-white European overall, and at least in my views, and because I had actually interviewed Kevin McDonald at the end of 2012 there, before I think actually I think that was still on Oracle, and then the network went defunct in March of that year, and then I interviewed him again on the network that I'm on now. But I had seen, it's like Red Ice had seen as well, that at least from their perspective, that here they had been covering conspiracies, and one of the biggest conspiracies that's actually open once you really start looking at it is the thing of white genocide. And at first I thought that term was like a little bit overstating the case, but if that, at least from people like going and hearing that in terms of what's the best way to call it in order to resonate with people. But frankly, you almost have to hit people over the head sometimes these days in order to get their attention. So I think it's as good a term as any that you can use for what's taking place. But similarly, like myself, of realizing that there is, I was aware of the whole Jewish issue going back to the early 90s, ironically from watching television with some of the documentary shows and stuff that I would watch where they would kind of demonize, oh, here's the KKK people, like they think that we Jews are not white and things like that. So ironically, way back then that I was awakened to the whole Jewish thing, and then just the blatant, obvious hypocrisy with Zionism. But of course, it goes back to the problems go back to before Israel, is like some people want to make it seem as if it's just about Zionism. But then it's like really, I think this is what I noticed like with Lee Rogers as well, realizing that the whole assault on the white European civilization is one of the key things that needs to be exposed and addressed. And this is, I found that this was, I never fully understood, I basically have to thank the Jewish elite and all the troubles they've caused for the past 2,000 years to fully go and realize my own identity, and also because they've been under assault as a group of people, and also to go and realize like what some of the big things are worth fighting for, and that it's, and like money is like one thing, but that there's this whole struggle that I was completely unaware of going on for 2,000 years that I only fully realized once I started exploring the whole racial aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. I think for Jews, money actually does come secondary to their ethnic or racial success, however you want to define them, their in-group success. And tied into that, they see that the only way that they can be successful is if everyone else is destroyed. Not necessarily completely obliterated, gone from the face of the earth. They need their slaves, but they want to see them demoralized. They want to see all the goyim really under their boot. And white people don't fit that role very well, or at least have not historically, as we can see from all of the times when Europeans expelled the Jews, when they had a little bit more sense, when they understood the issue a bit better. And now today, we are faced with an enemy who is assaulting us at every single different level, with billions and actually trillions of dollars, many of them stolen directly from us, because we have been enslaved by them. And when I said before that I really do think that they care more about their success and our destruction than making money, you can see this being played out in the advertisement, where you have all of these different commercials which are supposed to just be selling a product. Oh, we're going to be selling Old Spice. We're going to be selling laundry detergent. But in fact, what we are selling is the idea that the only way for you to be cool is to race mix. That white women, what you really desire is a black man. Or that multiculturalism is great. That we are all one and under this big, great diversity rainbow. And in the Super Bowl ad from, I think just this past year, we had all of those different ethnicities, all those different cultures being represented in the Coca-Cola ad. It had all of these different Americans all pissed off. And you've got to know that Coca-Cola knew that would happen. That was pretty much intended. You're showing a woman with a headscarf, wearing a hijab or a burqa, you know, singing in whatever language, Arabic, about singing America the Beautiful. So this is really showing me that they are much more interested in selling an idea that leads to our destruction and their success, rather than just selling the products. Would you agree that sometimes they put the economic profit motive behind more important goals that they have set for themselves?
Yes, I would agree with that. Like those examples you made, like you actually brought some of those things to my attention, actually listening to you. And then like following some of the discussion that came out of that about people just drawing attention more and more now that like YouTube's been around since 2005, I think, but just in the past year, even now the number of videos that you can go and see, like people waking up, they weren't even aware of this. It was like right in front of their face. Like, it's like interesting to look back to some of the television shows and movies. I've been doing that myself. Like even like looking the way they were pushing the whole gay thing for no apparent reason, like where's the money in that, right? Gay people are a small percentage of the population, but the thing is you could see where that serves really well the Jewish elite, the hostile Jewish elite, to push the whole gay agenda, because just completely undermines what had been the whole Christian basis of the country. And then, while I don't subscribe personally myself to Christianity as a religion, although I was originally raised in that, but the whole issue there is that it's this assault against restraint, for instance, and the majority that the restraint, like one thing it's to bring up here, actually the person who mentioned herself was Jewish, Judith Reisman, her first name was Judith, but she'd actually researched about the Kinsey reports and about the fraudulent nature of those things. But actually, Hugh Hefner, the Playboy magnate, that she had pointed out that he had been a virgin in college. And it was thanks to the Kinsey reports that were put out and promoted that he actually completely changed his lifestyle 180. So that's just a symbolism then of the kind of cultural takeover that you had. And the thing is that the whole Jewish self-interest just overall is very much at polar opposite on certain key areas. Like one thing would be gun control. There's no gun culture whatsoever. It'd be more like a kind of a Canadian type culture. Not even, of course, it's hostile, but not even in general, especially the Jewish elite. Oh, the only way that they would have guns if it's to protect themselves, but certainly not even for hunting. And then a big thing, like this is what Kevin McDonald has gotten to, is about free speech, that Jews as a group are completely against just the kind of free speech that's protected by the First Amendment. And this is exactly why it's significant that you have a big percentage of Jews that control so much of the media and the banking, because they represent a hostile elite, completely hostile to the actual founding principles and the whole special character of the United States.
For them, free speech equates to Hugh Hefner, what was the Larry Flint, Hustler, with his big free speech First Amendment case there. That's what they call free speech, is all sorts of depravity being considered art and being considered speech. These disgusting violent sex acts being carried out in California, that's considered free speech, what is supposed to be protected by the First Amendment. Also, free speech is calls for genocide against white people. Happens all of the time. New Black Panther Party. You've got Jamie Foxx on Saturday Night Live saying, he gets to kill all the white people. How great is that? To laughter and applause. There's example after example after example. I've gone through them on my show and on other shows as well. But it just goes to show what they're really all about. Because when we say anything that is about loving our people, that is about having some kind of group interest, that is considered hate, that is considered borderline terrorism, that's considered all sorts of evil. But they can just get away with the most disgusting acts in the name of free speech while they want us to be censored from expressing very natural, very healthy, and very righteous ideas.
Well, and I think that presents a great opportunity. This is one of the things that really always irked me once I found out about it a long time ago, about that aspect, the whole double standard, not specifically related to about the whole free speech double standard, but just in terms of, certain things about like the way, like Jewish families, like they may be like really close knit, but then if you notice that some of the big Hollywood executives who, of course, according to A. Fox, just happen to be Jewish, that the kind of movies that they put out, now that's in your face once you wake up to it. So you notice that whole thing. But again, that's the case of where, like, it's about the group interest there, or at least of this elite there among them. But, of course, you of course, miss out on the whole understanding of it, of if there's some control opposition that will then say, well, it's just only the Jewish elite. But then, no, you have the whole of the way it's a whole symbiotic relationship that eventually becomes completely toxic of that. It just screws over the average Jew as well. But of course the average Jew is not to the extent they're even aware of it, but they might figure that if they are aware of it, well, it's best to keep quiet. Why go and rock the boat? Because of like the same thing could happen to them as happens to the Gentile people who go in quite prominently organize and speak out against it. And one thing, it's really hope, like to try to wrap things up on a hopeful note, is that there are some really great Gentile people who spoke out about, like, we have a lot of problems in the world, like environmental things and such like that, and like real ones, not fake ones, and we have to like improve our own lives and restrain ourselves in certain ways and have good families and all that sort of thing. But the whole 2,000 years plus and even beyond that, one of the big things has been this struggle of, especially among the white Europeans, culture, and then which led to the kind of culture that most people aspire to having, at least they say that they would like a lot of the benefits that has been produced. But there's been this whole struggle between the Jews as outsiders within the society and with this elite that has gone and just got them all kicked out of the countries. And of course, and another aspect is the sellout Gentiles then who are very much 100% part of this as well. But
yes,
I think it's hopeful in terms of that there were people who courageously went and spoke out against it. Like you look at Henry Ford about going in. I remember reading back in like the mid to late 90s, once the internet, it was easier to get a somewhat of a decent connection, at least for text files. But I remember reading about him in the late 90s about on the internet then about the Dearborn Independent and how, now and then unfortunately he was taken to court and then, oh, he went and apologized for it. But there are these others, you look at even Congressman McFadden who didn't directly come out and said like these are a bunch of Jewish bankers, but he was, when he was going and criticizing the Federal Reserve in the 1930s, he was like a great hero. And at one final point that I think really drive home is that there was this aspect, like even though, like for myself, that I can point to things that I would disagree with the Catholic theology. But the one really important thing is that from what I've seen, that like all those countries where Jews were eventually kicked out were under Catholic control. Of course, it was mostly Catholic, obviously, until the 1500s anyway. So that's something you have to take into account. But there was this, I want to call it the actual golden era of Hollywood, was when the Jewish power was restrained through a boycott of Catholic. Specifically, there was a couple of them, but there was one prominent Catholic who actually had a boycott in Philadelphia of the movies, and the Warner Brothers, Mr. Warner Brother man guy, was losing a whole bunch of money. And this is where for the period of sometime in the 1930s, all the way up until I think around 68, was when they went and restrained what was on the television. And I would like to see a repeat of that come back completely through voluntary means, not through government coercion. But to give the credit, that's what actually the Catholics were able to do with the kind of organization that they had. And this is why you have disinfo agents out there. They won't go and criticize like Catholicism based on the actual theological points, but they'll put out misinformation about Jesuits going and running the banking system, or that there's some other species going and running things, will be put out there because there was that aspect of the Catholics were a big threat to the Jewish power structure.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying there with the boycotts is that perhaps we should put our money where our mouth is. And if we're able to have a strong enough organization behind this, we could really start to change things. It seems that this is what the Norwegians, the youth in Norway, were doing on that island, Utøya, before they were murdered by the Zionist Anders Breivik. They were organizing a boycott of Israel. There has been this big divestment movement as well that has been taking hold. Would you care to comment at all upon how we can financially ruin our enemies, just like they've been financially ruining us for a very long time, and then we'll close out the show for the night?
Well, there's the local currencies is one way to do that. Usury free is some patterns already exist, like the mountain hours in Colorado. And that's the way to get as local as possible, get to know some people who are like-minded and things, take it off the internet to the extent that you can. Of course, everyone's so fragmented the way it's hard to find people who are like get it on certain issues. But that's the thing. I'm really positive now. I used to be so instilled with fear and, well, not so much fear, but the lack of things by listening to Alex Jones and that. But I'm so positive now when I've heard about these different things of, and it's this struggle that, but actually there have been the days where the people have won against this whole system. And, but one of the big ways is to get rid of usury, that you don't need to have any sort of, usury in order to facilitate the exchange between producers.
All right. Fantastic. Jason, would you please promote your website and let us know if you've got anything exciting coming up in the future?
And it's faux-capitalist.com, and I'm very much looking forward to writing some articles about this very, very directly. The main focus had been about economics, but I'm looking forward to speaking out more about some of these issues. I've been very outspoken against Zionism on the site. I try to appeal to an audience. Like, this is the thing, something that people don't realize is they try to be all things to all people. This is why it's so important to have a lot of people talking about things from different angles, because this is exactly how the mass media goes and controls people, as they have their little stooges out there to go and talk from a certain angle to keep people captured. But the more people who can talk about it, you know, you might somehow be a Zionist, but if you can talk about the excesses of Jewish power, then that's just great. And if you're a Catholic and you want to talk about it, that's great too. This is how we're going to reach people. And also another big thing that I look forward to exposing is just more and more of some of the phonies within the alternative media, and also about the media fakery that I'm noticing. But you will actually have some prominent people not talk about, like, hey, who controls Hollywood? There's a reason why, like, the guy who wrote the book An Empire of Their Own was talking about Jewish Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, there's that motto from a certain intelligence agency that says, by way of deception, thou shalt wage war. And that is what they are doing with their control of mass media. And they're trying to accomplish a number of different objectives with these different events that are being put forth. But, Jason, that is certainly a topic for perhaps another day. I know you also comment over at a certain site, Mammies, as it is known, grism.blogspot.com. Just wanted to promote that. You comment on some of my shows, and I think you usually have very insightful comments over there. So if people are a little bit interested in getting your thoughts on different characters who are featured over there, that would be a good place to go. Anything to say about Mammies?
Oh, I think it's a great site. I'm glad that they brought in some sort of moderation there of the comments, because it was really out of control, although it was kind of revealing and entertaining as far as, like, just somehow since 2006 with researching, going back to the AIDS scam, that this is actually how I started finding out about massive fraud and controlled opposition. So just somehow I've been thrust in. It's been one of my most interesting things, is to research this whole business of disinformation specialists, disinformation overall. And but it's a great site in terms of I like it in terms of the kind of issue, addressing the Jewish issue, and not from like some white supremacist background, as the Jewish elites will actually intentionally go and create to go and discredit any discussion of Jewish power among the masses.
Yes, I very much do think that that is controlled opposition that has been set up, the kind of neo-Nazi, KKK, white power type of mindset. And real briefly, I'm just going to comment upon this topic, and then we will close it out. Just going to drag this a little bit further into the archives. I think that the reason we saw so much of that in the past, that kind of, let's say, low-brow opposition to Jewish power and to multiculturalism, is because it was the lower classes within the larger white family that were being affected first by these issues. they were affected economically, whereas the middle class, which still existed, wasn't being as hard hit. And the middle class was able to flee to white suburbs. And now what we're seeing is that these issues of Jewish power and of uncontrolled immigration and forced integration, it is affecting even going up to the some of the highest elements of white society. And it is becoming an existential threat to white people at all different socioeconomic stratuses. And this is what is changing our opposition to this global power elite, is that we have more intelligent people working on the problem, putting forth propaganda, and organizing activism. And we are moving away from some of the lowbrow, uninformed, or misinformed criticism of the enemy. And that's why we're being so much more successful. And hopefully with people like you speaking out about these issues, like people like Henrik speaking out about these issues, we will be able to see more and more success and continue to elevate our message and really put forth a vision of the future that is one that many people can get behind and will want to be part of when it starts to materialize.
I agree that, yeah, that's a good diagnosis then of why there's the different groups of white people that are going and talking about this. And you notice the assault on so many different ways, like whether it's the housing and urban development. We don't notice that in Canada, but then Canada is a poster child for the model of multiculturalism that they want to have. It just such a disservice that they did to the European population that had made up 96% of the population. And it's interesting, something that you were talking about, like that they say that, oh, Canada, well, let's just focus on Canada. Canada is not a white nation. Well, it's right now, or at least with the last census in 2011, was around 75% white. And apparently then Israel is not a Jewish country with around 75% Jewish population. So there's the major double standard here. And we got to speak up about these things while we still have the chance before we do become a minority.
Well, South Africa is not a black country, okay? Just because blacks are the majority down there doesn't mean it's a black country.
Yes.
Race is just a social construct, African men. Okay? You got to get over all of that. It's come on, it's 2014. You're living in the past. Of course, these double standards exist. And I think we will honestly get to the point of South Africa if we don't stand up now and do something about it. And what's going on in South Africa is genocide in the way most people think of it. Not the genocide that's taking place in European lands where we're being attacked physically, but not at the level that's going on there. Most of it is demoralization and just open borders. But down there, people are being brutalized, slaughtered, and the white minority is still being handicapped with affirmative action. It's not that the minority down there is getting the help from affirmative action. They have affirmative action for the majority. That's how much the minority is being discriminated against in South Africa. And now that we see the United States moving to the point where 50%, over 50% of the students in school are non-whites now. And yet whites are still being blamed for everything. Whites are still being said to have privilege. I think that's why they have to bring this in now. Now that whites are no longer the majority, they need to stay in some kind of privileged status so that they can't get some kind of minority protection or rights. It doesn't matter that you're a minority. You've got privilege. So that's why we got to take you down a few notches. That's why we can't allow you to say this or that. That's why we're going to have you collectively punished. And so I honestly do think that the more in your face this gets, with all this white guilt, white privilege, white genocide programming, that that's really going to inspire people to stand up against it. And that it gives me hope seeing what has been taking place in these past few months and few years as our opposition gets better and better and bigger and bigger. Jason, I thank you so much for being a part of it and for speaking with me here tonight. Any final thoughts are yours, sir.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on the show, and it's actually been one of the ones that I've most been anticipating of several of the interviews that I've done, because I like to talk about the whole issue about the white genocide. That really is the one remaining thing that a lot of people either don't see or they don't want to talk about. And to talk about it, that's the thing against this kind of hyper tribalism, Jewish power, is that it's great. Let's all get together, non-white people as well. It just so happens that I'm white, that you're white, and that the super majority of, well, still to this, at least in the United States, it's not going to be for long, are white as well. And also based upon the history as well, that it just so happens that we have to be the ones who lead this as white people to go and speak out against this issue right now. And let's join together, but let's actually have that let's actually go and preserve the heritage that we have that was only possible with the people that founded it in a majority situation. And that's my final thoughts on it for tonight.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you. And people can check you out at faux-capitalist.com. Jason, again, thank you, and we'll be in touch. And I want to thank all of you out there listening at renegadebroadcasting.com. Check out all the great shows here on the network, and I'll be speaking with you again next week.
certainly wasn't the right.